It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day, and every spring, those first warm, lovely days allow us to relish the change of season. Then a couple of days later, the mosquitoes start biting, the ticks start showing up, and the gnats start swarming. This hour, we'll talk about the insects of spring. We'll also get the lowdown on some spring gardening deadlines. With me, Donald Lewis, professor of entomology at Iowa State University, also with ISU Extension. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure.
Linda Nave is also with here, Iowa State University Extension Specialist in Value-Added Agriculture. Hello, Linda.
Hi, Charity. It's good to be here, too,
well,
on a rainy day.
Yes. But... not a great gardening day, but a great day to talk about gardening.
Yes.
And, of course, a great day for mosquitoes to breed. Right, Donald?
Well, if the water stays around, it will be a great day. And if we don't get too much rain, there's this happy medium between too much rain that flushes the temporary impoundments where mosquitoes live and not enough rain so that those impoundments dry up. Right in the middle, if the impoundments stay full of water, mosquitoes continue to breed and enjoy the summer like the rest of us.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of these spring bug populations. And actually, I want to start with ticks because I have seen a lot of articles this spring so far popping up saying this is going to be the worst tick season ever. What's your response to that?
Maybe, maybe not. We won't know until it's done. Now, the other problem with this is there is no census of ticks. There is no systematic survey of how many ticks are really out there. What we get are the observations of people whose memories may or may not be accurate to how bad it was last year or how good it was last year or how good it was 10 years ago. So we have all these observations of, oh, I saw a lot of ticks. Well, of course, a lot has no quantitative value to it. So we end up with all these little bits and pieces. Then we also get doctors on TV saying, whoa, it was a mild winter, therefore we'll have more bugs. Yeah, and life's usually not that simple, but it made a good soundbite on TV or it makes a good soundbite in a news article. So we don't know. But that doesn't keep us from guessing and trying to make some predictions, although insects have a way of proving us wrong.
So it sounds like you're saying don't panic.
Don't panic. It's not as bad as it. And of course, the other thing is, as we look at the articles that are coming out, many of them are coming from the East Coast. Many of them are written by people who may have a vested interest in a large tick population. Sometimes they're written about hire us to control your tick problems in your yard, or sometimes it has kind of an alarmist tone by the way it was written. So I always take some of this with a grain of salt and know perfectly well that the ticks are going to do what the ticks are going to do. The mosquito population is yet to be determined, and there usually are not simple answers to complex questions.
Now, you guys do hear from people who encounter ticks and are concerned about ticks. Are you hearing much so far?
Actually, it's not as much as I would have expected. I was sort of braced because I'd been hearing the same news stories and seeing the same Facebook posts that you mentioned, and I thought we would hear more, but it's been sort of typical. It's also typical in the fact that two different kinds of callers will call the university to ask about ticks. The first call will be, wow, there are a lot more ticks, and how come there are so many this year? The second caller of the day will say, I haven't seen any ticks. Why aren't there any out there? So the tick population varies from place to place. It varies from time to time. And the average is probably somewhere in the middle, but people either seem to think there's a lot or they think there's none.
Well, we've talked many times about how we all sort of live in our own little microcosm. And as you know, I spend a lot of time out walking, often in long grass. I encounter a lot of ticks. In my microcosm, it's a medium year.
It's a medium year. Okay.
Yep. Medium year.
Now, if you would actually collect data and say, when I walk this 100-meter length in a matter of 30 seconds, I collected this many ticks. We need the numbers, Charity. We need to know what
next year.
We need to know what medium means.
Does medium mean that you find one or two on your pants when you get home?
Yes, approximately. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, different days and sometimes dogs, although the ticks don't bite the dogs because the dogs have been spotted, but sometimes they take a ride home on the dogs.
Yes, they do.
You see them later. And we've only encountered wood ticks so far. I mean, that's an important thing for people who encounter ticks because people are really nervous about ticks, how do you identify a tick when you do find one?
There are plenty of guides online, and Iowa State University has a tick pamphlet that you can get through the Iowa State University Extension store. And it shows you the three different ticks that are common in Iowa. If you start your description by saying it was the size of a grape, I immediately know you're talking about the American dog tick, which is also known as the wood tick, which is the reddish-brown one that is sort of an egg shape. It's wider at the back than it is at the front. If you're talking about a round tick, that's usually our Lone Star tick. And if you have an adult female, you'll know why it's called the Lone Star tick, because it has a single white dot on a dark background. The small orangish-colored tick is the one that's called the black-legged tick, which the news media insists on calling the deer tick, but it already had the name black-legged tick before that the new moniker came out. So those are our three ticks. American dog tick is far and away the more common of the ones. The Lone Star tick is more of a southern species, although we now find it through most of Iowa. And then the third one is the black-legged tick.
And the black-legged tick is the one that most people are worried about. Do you have some advice for people who want to protect themselves from ticks, too?
Number one, don't do like Charity. Don't spend time in the tall grass.
But I enjoy that, so I'm going to keep doing it.
You're going to keep doing it. So if you can avoid tall grass, weedy areas, brushy areas, if you stay in the lawn, if you stay on the trails in the woods, you'll have fewer encounters with ticks. Number two, it looks nerdy, but stick your pant legs into your socks. That keeps the ticks on the outside of your clothing rather than coming up on the inside. You can put mosquito repellent on your shoes, your socks, and your pant cuffs. That will help as well. When you come inside from being outdoors in a potential tick area, check for ticks. If you can, take a shower when you come inside to wash off any ticks that have not yet embedded. And those things will protect you most of the time, but keep checking to see if a tick got embedded before you got it washed off or before you found it.
All right. Now, let's talk about some of these other insects. Let's talk about mosquitoes. Of course, they start showing up pretty much as soon as it gets warm. What kind of word have you been hearing about mosquitoes this year?
Off to a slow start. It's been wet enough for mosquitoes, but it's also been cool when it's been wet. Today, for example, is a cold, cool, rainy day. So while we have the moisture, we don't have the temperatures that would allow the mosquitoes to reproduce. So they are there, but they're off to a slow start. Some mosquito species spend the winter as adults, and they're ready to start laying eggs as soon as it warms up and we have water out there. Other mosquitoes have to wait for that first flood in order for their eggs to hatch, the eggs that spent the winter. So we're off to a slow start, and what happens next will depend on those two factors we've already mentioned. Will there be standing water? Will there be warm temperatures? We have to have both.
All right, we've also got the first flush of gnats floating around in the air. Again, from my microcosm, it's a medium gnat year, not too bad. Certainly not gnat-free. They tend to come in waves, right? So we'll see them now and for a couple of weeks, and then we may see them again later?
It depends on which of the dozens of species that we can group under the umbrella gnat.
And I have no idea.
That you're talking about. Gnats or midges or fungus gnats, these are all things that are out there. Some of them come from standing water. Some of them come from running water. Some of them come from very wet soil. So we've got the conditions to produce them. But some areas do get, especially along lakes and rivers, they get these emergences of gnats. And it does seem like they come in these waves. There'll be a few and then they're gone. Other gnats are more likely to be here year-round. And then, of course, the ones like the fungus gnats depend on wet soil, and so they will be the ones that we'll notice next.
I have a quick question on that same regard, since I'm here. What about mayflies?
Well, mayflies come in May, June, July, August, and September, so they're not just this month. Mayflies come from running water that is clear and does well. I've not heard yet of any mayfly emergences along the Mississippi River, which is kind of our harbinger, and it's usually the 4th of July when we get our best emergences of mayflies in that area.
That's interesting, because I remember my in-laws lived on a small lake, and some years they were really bad and like lousy all over the house. And some years, many years, not. But
it's the vagaries of life, isn't it, Charity?
It certainly is. All right, Linda, speaking of spring, let's talk about plant deadlines, because we waited and waited and waited to plant, and now all of a sudden we're past Mother's Day, which is sort of your deadline for getting in the peppers and the tomatoes. How long a planting window do we have for some of our vegetables?
You know, it depends on the particular crop, really. Some things germinate best at cold temperatures, and our planting deadlines relate to the soil temperatures and how well they germinate at specific soil temperatures. So that's why we say radishes should be planted in April and May, because it's a spring crop. No, it's because they germinate best under cool soil temperatures. And at some higher temperatures, they will not germinate at all. For example, lettuce. Lettuce will not germinate when soil temperatures are above 95. But when they're 77, they'll come up in 3-4 days. So it just depends on the crop. But right now, in the middle of May, we've had some very cool days. Things can still be planted direct seeded. Radishes, you can go in for your last planting of radishes at this time. Leaf lettuce is almost over for a while because we're coming into the warmer periods where the soil temperatures are high. Let's just look at what will happen when we plant lettuce at, if we plant lettuce at 59 degrees, it'll be up in 4 days. If we plant at 77 degrees soil temperature, 2 days. But if we get up to 90, they won't germinate at all. So, and sometimes our very black soils do heat up quite readily and quite rapidly. So those are the things we need to consider.
So you may be taking a chance, too, because we can't necessarily predict the temperatures here in Iowa.
Right. But if we look at carrots, for example, we can plant carrots through June, practically, and then again in the late July, early August time, because the soil temperature isn't that critical, and it starts cooling down then. So we have opportunities for that. So the overall story is it's not too late to plant many things, but we're near, very, very near the deadline with many.
All right. This is a great weekend to plant. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm here with Linda Nave and Donald Lewis. They are here to answer your questions about plants and insects. You can join the conversation. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Donald Lewis, Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University, Linda Nave, ISU Extension Specialist in Value-Added Agriculture. They are here to answer your questions about the plants and insects you encounter. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So, Linda, just before the break, we were talking about for those early spring crops, we have just a small window left for planting and possibly getting a good harvest out of them. For the warmer weather crops, how broad is this window? Of course, that means I need you to be psychic and tell me what's going to happen in August and September.
Not necessarily, because I'm not quite that psychic, because that deals more with our soil temperatures up. Our warm season crops can germinate at temperatures of 90 degrees without much problems, such as muskmelons, watermelons, squash. However, they have a longer growing season, and so we can't wait too long to plant those, or otherwise our crop will not mature before the first fall frost. So we've got to take into consideration if it's a 100-day plant to get to the first fruit to be harvested, when we want more than one, then we need to think about maybe 110, 120 days out for planting. So think about that. Sweet potatoes are another one. Most of us start them as little transplants, of course, little plants, slips, so to speak. But they do require a longer season in order to produce their tubers at the tuberous roots at the very end. So these such situations, you got to think about the growing season and the length the crop requires for maturity.
And for procrastinators who still want to make sure that they get the warm season crops and get a good harvest, does it make sense to go to the garden center and buy the larger transplants?
That is a very good question. Not necessarily. Many of the larger transplants are terribly root bound, and so you have to break up that little root mass and transplant it. They go through greater transplant shock. Actually, if you're going to have a tomato plant become established more quickly, be sure to harden it off for a few days, meaning keep it in its cell packs, set it outdoors, gradually acclimate it to the outdoor light levels, and gradually acclimate it to in a little less water. It may flag or droop a little bit, water it back. So harden it off, get it prepared for the outdoors. That helps. But typically we say a tomato plant that has 5 to 7 true leaves on it, meaning the tomato leaves, perfect. Not too tall, not too root bound, makes for a perfect transplant. However, if they put that tomato plant in a larger container, perhaps a 4-inch pot, fine. I mean, it can accommodate that for a certain level of time, and if it grows larger. Typically, we don't like to plant out tomatoes into the garden that have flowers or fruits already set on. That will hold them back, and they will not establish themselves as well. And sometimes those early fruits will fall off due to the transplant shock.
Seems like I consistently learn that there's no way to cheat in gardening. It's very disappointing.
No, no, there's no real way to cheat. I mean, you can put a row cover over your tomato plants early in the season, protect them for a few degrees. So you can cheat a little bit. And that's what commercial growers do, is they cheat a little bit. Or they have tricks of the trade that help them deal with those situations. Maybe I wouldn't call it cheating.
All right. Well, we've got a lot of questions in email and on the line. The phone number 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we have this email. This is on the subject of ticks. This is from Laura in Fort Dodge. All I know is that on Tuesday morning, there was a tick on my coffee cup on the kitchen counter. I assume one of my dogs brought it in, but who knows? It seems too early for ticks. It seems like now it's never too early for ticks, Donald.
Well, they spend the winter hunkered down under the tall grass. They're down under the mulch and under the leaf litter on the forest floor. And as soon as that environment gets warm, as in 55 to 60 degrees, they're going to come out of hibernation and begin wandering around looking for a food source to sort of catch up with the all the energy they lost during hibernation. So it's not driven by the calendar, it's driven by the temperature.
And I have, and this winter, I certainly encountered a few ticks over the winter as well with our warm temperatures. So
all those really warm days back in February that we wondered about if there was really going to be a winter. If they were in an area where the soil surface could get warm enough, the ticks would be active, and because they're cold blooded, they can go back into dormancy. But when they warm up, they become active again.
All right, let's go to the phones. Karen is on the line in Ames. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I planted a contender peach tree last spring early. It was quite large, the largest I could get. But I'm really surprised this spring. It's about 11 feet tall and has dozens of peaches on it. And I'm worried that's too many for such a small tree. Or should I allow any peaches to develop at all?
Well, what happens when you have a fruit set on a fruit tree that's overabundant, the fruits that are do set on are smaller. And so you might want to go out and thin a bit. And it can weight the branches down, cause some limb damage. So I would go out and definitely thin some of those out if you find they're too close together. Generally, we say with fruits, I'm not sure exactly with peaches, but with apples, we're saying about 6 inches apart so that you get a good distance between them, so they're not shading each other, so they're not robbing each other of water and nutrients.
All right. I have 5 peaches right in a cluster on many branches.
Yeah.
So it sounds like I should take most of them off.
Yeah, and do that very soon. So don't wait too long.
But it's no problem to allow a tree to bear in its second year.
It depends the size of the tree it was. How old was the planting? You know, sometimes if you have a small tree with a single stem, then yes, you should pull them all off. But in the case you said you planted the largest one possible, it may be a little older to begin with.
Right, so it's its second year with you, but not its second year.
Exactly.
Right. It has quite a few branches, and it was about 7 feet tall when I planted it. So
I think you're fine, second year.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Karen. Next up, we've got Richard in Indianola. Hi, Richard.
Good morning. I have a question about carpenter bees.
Okay.
How I would describe, and you probably already know, about the size of a bumblebee, no yellow, instead black and brown.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do or what do you recommend to treat the wood to keep them off?
Carpenter bees look like bumblebees. They're the same size. Bumblebees have a fuzzy abdomen. Carpenter bees have a shiny black abdomen. Carpenter bees, the females, burrow into bare, aged, or seasoned wood, and they drill a hole about half an inch in diameter into the surface of the wood, turn and go at a right angle with the grain for about 6 to 8 inches, and they kick out a large volume of sawdust to make this chamber, this tunnel, inside the wood, where they provision it with nectar and pollen, and then they lay their eggs, and next year her offspring will emerge from that nest. Well, there's not a lot we can do. I can suggest some things to try. Number one is stand in the yard with your badminton racket and ping them out of the air. The second thing is you can treat the new holes with insecticide dust that will kill the female bee as she comes and goes through that dust. A third option is to paint the bare wood. Now, if this is the joists under your deck, that may be okay. But if this is in the roof of your cabin, you won't want to do that. As far as wood preservatives or stains, that doesn't seem to stop them, but wood does. The fourth option is one I suggest with some reservation. You can go online and get plans for building a carpenter bee trap. This is a block of wood that's already got a half-inch hole in it, and somehow that hole connects to a funnel that drops her down into a jar, and maybe you can trick her into falling into your trap, and then you can relocate her or throw her away. So those are your four options, and none of them are perfect, none of them are good, but you can either battle her one-on-one, you can paint the wood, you can treat the nest holes, or you can try one of these traps.
Okay, very quickly, what kind of dust do you recommend?
A garden dust or a household insecticide dust. That probably means for most people it's going to be the insecticide 7, the same garden dust we've put on our vegetables for the last 50 years. Now you just have to figure out how to puff it into a vertical hole.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Richard. And Donald, are we going to be seeing a lot more carpenter bees?
We already are.
All right.
40 years ago when I started, I had one or two samples from the counties that are adjacent to Missouri. I'd hear from Lee County. I would hear from just way down on the border. And now we have carpenter bees as far north as at least Nevada and Ames. Now, one of the things about carpenter bees is maybe we should love them. It's hard to believe that there could be any value to something that's drilling holes in the joists of my deck. But they are pollinators. They're coming at a time of the year when we need some pollinators. They are part of the pollinator ecosystem. They may not be the most effective at it, but they are out on our flowers as well. So that would be one reason to tolerate them. But boy, when they're drilling holes in the rafters of your machine shed, it's awfully hard to think favorably upon them.
Well, okay, on this subject of thinking favorably upon insects that bother us, this is an email from Kate. She said, in my daily quest to be positive, I struggle with a few things. Gnats, mosquitoes, and ticks are all on that list. My question is, what are any redeeming and positive things one can say about these dangerous and irritating insects?
You know, it's one of those philosophical questions. Does something have to have a purpose in order to exist? Can't things just be? Can't they just exist without having to have a greater purpose? Well, in this regard, the first thing you think of when in that particular list of critters is they are part of a food chain, that they are eating something and something is going to eat them. In the case of midges and mosquitoes, it's a lot of bats and birds that get to eat that food resource. I'm not sure who eats ticks, but there must be
possums eat ticks.
Possums and raccoons. So being a link in the food chain is one of the things we can say. We can also say that insects are beneficial because of the services they provide, and that includes pollination, but it also includes the destruction of decaying organic matter. What would happen to all the dead plant material that accumulates in the wet areas if the midge larvae weren't there to feed on it? So we can talk about those surfaces as well, but it is hard to love some of these things, and sometimes we have to look pretty hard to find a purpose, but the the big ecosystem of the world seems to run on all these little tiny connections, and we would hate to destroy any of them.
Well, Kate, I hope that helps. Is there a philosophy class that you have to take when you become an entomologist?
No, it happens with time.
All right. Here's a question from Kay in Dubuque. I want to plant a snowdrift crabapple for its food value for birds. If it's too late to plant in May, when's the next best time to plant it? Are there any negatives for this malice variety?
That particular variety, I'm not an ornamental tree specialist. Snowdrift is probably an old one. It's an old one that's been around, very susceptible to scab, but beautiful. So there are some better varieties out there to look for, and we do have some lists available online that do list better varieties. But as far as planting, no, it's not too late to plant. Make sure you give it plenty of water. I wouldn't plant it during the heat of the summer. Get it in as soon as possible. If you don't hit that window of opportunity yet this spring, you can go ahead and plant later in the fall, and then mulch. Give it a good layer of mulch around it. Don't heap it up against the bark. You know, what you want to do is keep it away from the tree trunk itself if you're going to put a 2-inch layer of a mulch on so that it doesn't rot that young tree's bark. But mulch is very important, and it should go out to about the edge of the tree line right now. Keep any type of grasses or other competition away from those young trees.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Jack is on the line in Marshalltown. Hi, Jack.
Good morning. This may be a little off topic, but I have white grubs in my lawn. I have pulled a 1-foot square up in an area that is pretty thin, mostly quack grass, not much bluegrass. I found 7 or 8 small white grubs. Should I treat now or wait a little longer?
The grubs you see are done causing you harm. The ones you see are no longer a problem to you. The 7 or 8 in a square foot area is below what we think is an important threshold anyway. It takes 10 to 20 per square foot to cause a problem. But damage to turf grass from white grubs happens in late August, September, and into October. So now is not the time to worry about grubs. Now would not be the time to try to kill those that are there. Let's say you did kill those 7. It's not going to change what happens in July when the next flush of beetles emerge and begin laying eggs. If you want to prevent white grubs, you've got between now and the middle of August to put down a preventive insecticide such as Merit or Grub X or Acelaprin or Arena. You've got time to put that down so that it's in the soil by the middle of August to prevent the next problem. The ones you have now are no longer an issue for you.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your help.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Jack. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's a question from Ted that's going to involve me mispronouncing a lot of things. He says, I have 6 groups of Liatris keybold.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That were planted 4 to 5 years ago. Last year, one planting did not bloom. This spring, it appears that 2 groups, the one that did not bloom last year and another one, will not be blooming based on lack of flower shoots present so far. These plants get moderate light and are well drained. Any ideas and or solutions as to why some are not blooming?
Well, let's talk about what Liatris is for those who want some. What is that?
That's great. Clearly, I'm in that category.
Liatris is sometimes called blazing star. It's a native prairie plant. It likes warm, dry conditions, somewhat dry. So if you've got that planted in and sunny. So prairie, of course, dictates sun. It dictates somewhat dry during the growing season. It doesn't like deep planting. The corms try to establish themselves fairly close to the soil surface if you were to dig them out. And the clumps grow, and oftentimes they grow so thick that they sort of choke each other out. And that may be happening, but the key is you can divide those out if you want. And in the prairie situation, they do die down, but a new colony establishes itself. Are they great? Yes, they are. You see them in flower arrangements, those the purple spikes that bloom like a firecracker burns. So most of the time, the flowers open on the bottom of the spike, but in the case of Liatris, it blooms first on the top and then works its way down.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, so time and patience, yes. Sounds like, is mm-hmm. the recommendation there. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Linda Nave, ISU Extension Specialist in Value-Added Agriculture, and Donald Lewis, Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University. You are welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, entomologist Donald Lewis, horticulturist Linda Nave. They are here to answer your questions about plants and insects. Give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And here's another email question. This is from Tammy in Iowa City. Is it too late to plant asparagus crowns?
Yes, it is. I would not put asparagus crowns in now because we're getting towards the end of the planting season. If you find some on sale, you want to take the risk, fine. But I would not start a large bed of asparagus right now. Your best bet to planting is early April. Get the crowns, get them in the ground. But that doesn't dictate that you can harvest the first year. With asparagus, we suggest that you wait at least a year with the male hybrids and then harvest just a week or so off of that. And then by the third year, you can harvest clear up until the middle of June. But again, the sooner you get it in the spring, the better.
All right. So there's one thing that it is definitely too late for, probably.
Yes.
Okay. Here's a question from Mitch. He says, do you have suggestions for getting rid of fungus gnats on a peace lily? I have dried out the soil for multiple weeks and also tried neem oil with a hydrogen peroxide solution soak with moderate success.
Wow. that should have worked. Indoors, we think of fungus gnats as being a symptom of too wet too long, potting soil that's too wet too long. So Mitch has already done what we recommend, and that is to let the soil dry out. It may take repeated dryings. That would be my next thought, that it might not happen with one letting it dry down. But I usually think of, peace lily, is that the one that droops so badly when it's dry? it tells you immediately that it's too dry, but it always seems to spring back up. So try that again. The next step would be gnat trawl, which is a material that the greenhouse growers use. It's a Bacillus thuringiensis product that is specific to Diptera or fly larvae. It's a product you can mix with water and put on the soil. I don't think the hydrogen peroxide helped at all. The neem oil probably bound up with the organic matter and didn't reach the larvae that are just below the surface. So try natural, try another wilting period, or learn to love them.
They don't do much damage to your plants, though, do they?
No. Greenhouse people hate fungus gnats because when they are establishing seedlings in that really moist medium, the fungus gnats will actually chew on the root hairs and on the roots of their little tender seedlings. An established plant is not going to suffer from fungus gnat larvae in the soil because the fungus gnats are going to feed on the decaying organic matter more than on the roots themselves.
Okay. Of course, people just don't tend to like them in their house.
No, that's the problem. The other thing you could try is yellow sticky traps. These are the little yellow cards that you see in the greenhouse when you walk by. Sometimes they're a flat card. Sometimes they make, I've seen these cute little yellow sticky cards. They're on a green stem, and the card sort of folds over on itself, and it looks like yellow flowers on a green plastic stem. It's kind of
beautiful.
A cute way to make a trap. All that will do is harvest the adults from the population, and maybe a sticky card would be a way to reduce the population before they get into your living space.
Sure, make them a little bit less irritating.
There you go.
Here's a question from Eric in Algona. When is the best time to spray fruit trees, and what product should be used?
Well,
and that's a pretty general question as far as kind of fruit trees.
And we're going to just stick with apples because that's the fruit that's going to be most reliable here. And the next question is, does your livelihood depend on producing a huge crop of perfect fruit? If so, you're looking at 3 to 7 sprays throughout the course of the summer. You're talking about sprays that happen in the springtime before the blooms are on. You're talking about a spray that happens right after bloom when the little green fruit are just beginning. And then you're talking about several more sprays toward the middle of the summer. There is no one and done fruit tree spray. The schedule is going to depend on what is your major pest problem. I'm assuming if it's a backyard, the biggest problem is going to be apple maggots. And for that, you spray an all-purpose fruit spray, fruit tree spray, beginning about the middle of June and a couple times every 10 to 2 weeks after that, depending on the weather. This would be a good reason to go online and find a university fruit spray schedule. There is no one time. There are all these different times for different pests, and you have to figure out what's best for you. Now, if your livelihood doesn't depend on apples, I would say take what you get and enjoy it. Cut it up into little pieces and make apple pies, or just make it all into applesauce. Don't worry about the minor damage that you might have had.
All right. Let's go to the phones. Ralph is on the line in Grinnell. Hi, Ralph.
Hi there. I planted a greengage plum tree 20 years ago, and last year it started sending up some side ones so I could cut them off and plant them someplace else with a root ball on it. Everything died. There was nothing come up this year. No buds, no nothing. There isn't such a thing as fire blight for stone fruit, is there?
Yes. You would have seen that last year. The twigs at the ends of the branches will sort of crook over and they'll turn brown and it looks like someone scorched them. So fire blight wouldn't be a problem.
No.
There are also borers that could be in the trunk of a stressed tree. So maybe...
Even the little young ones are all dead. Oh.
Well, the little young ones probably didn't get a chance to become established. And so that could have created a problem for those. And the suckering may be a sign that that tree was under some type of stress to begin with, that it threw up that many suckers.
It was a last-ditch effort?
Not necessarily last-ditch, but an effort.
But wouldn't 20 years be a good long life for a plum tree in Iowa?
Yes, it would.
Yeah, it's like peaches that we really want them to live forever, but we're going to outlive them.
Yeah, well, peaches are very short-lived.
Plant every 5 years, right?
Yeah.
So don't plant anything near where those ones died. Maybe that would help.
Oh, no, we're talking about things that are very mobile. In the case of the adult stage of the borers, in the case of the pathogen moving about the air, moving about with insects and so forth. So as long as there wasn't...
A soil-borne disease,
a soil
and it
doesn't
sound like it.
Yeah, or groundhogs in the root system or something like that. No, you can go back in that area.
All right, Ralph, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Kathy in Illinois. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. I have questions on two different plants. I was just given a rose bush for Mother's Day, and I noticed that some of the leaves have brown patches on them, not like they're crumpled brown, but just dark brownish green. And I didn't know if that was a problem or an issue, or if I should just ignore it. It might be normal for that rose.
What I would do I would not do anything with it right now, but see if the new foliage grows out of it. It could be a disease problem, but at the same time, it could be something environmental that it picked up at the garden center or when you planted it. So see if the new growth outgrows those symptoms. That would be my first clue before I would do anything.
All right, so just wait it out for a while.
Wait it out, because it's not going to kill the plant right now if those little spots don't grow in size. If they're staying the same size, you're fine.
All right, Kathy, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Renee in Denver. Hi, Renee. Renee, are you there? All right, we seem to have lost Renee in Denver. Next up, Jim in Urbandale. Hi, Jim.
Hi, I've got a green spruce tree that I planted 20 years ago. When I planted it, it was probably about 4 feet tall. I put some retaining wall stones around it because it was on a very slight incline. As the tree has grown over the years, I took away the retaining wall stones from inside the tree. And ever since then, the inside of the tree appears to be getting thinner and thinner, although the outsides of the branches are very healthy and continue to grow.
We're both agreeing on the same thing. Yep. We're both nodding our head that, yeah, you did the right thing. You took the retaining stones down, but the tree will naturally do that. It's going to thin itself out on its own.
Only okay. the outside edge of a conifer tree is alive,
mm-hmm.
At least in our pines, spruces, and firs. So you may have 3 to 5 years of needles on the mm-hmm. outside edge. Everything older than that is kaput and has dropped to the ground. Now, if you only have 1 or 2 years of needles on the outside, then we need to be talking to the plant disease clinic about maybe a fungus that is killing the older needles. That's really common on our blue spruce trees.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe this is normal, but we need to take a closer look at exactly how much of the outside of the tree is alive.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and if I'm looking at it right now, and it's probably a good 18 inches to 2 feet.
You're fine.
I think you're fine. I think the hollowness inside a tree is normal, inside
okay.
a conifer tree.
Very good. Thank you so much. Have a great
yep.
day.
Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Barb in Des Moines. Hi, Barb.
Hi. I'd like to have two questions.
Okay.
Number one is right now in my backyard, there's a 15-foot bush blooming, and it's all pink, and it's just beautiful. And I know you've mentioned it before, but I can't what is the name of that bush? It's just beautiful in Des Moines.
Is it beauty bush?
Blooming pink, covered with blooms.
Yeah.
Well, honeysuckle is in bloom right now.
How big are the blooms?
Just tiny, tiny little pink blooms, and it's got a shaggy bark, a white bark.
I still think we're talking about honeysuckle, aren't we?
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
What do the leaflets look like? Is it a larger leaf or small leaves?
Small leaf.
We're still thinking it's a honeysuckle, but if you'd like to send us a picture, we'll be glad to look at it and see if we can make an identification mm-hmm. from the picture.
Oh, thank you. I would love that. And my second question is, I have a climbing rose that I'm trying to get up a trellis, but some of the limbs are going more parallel to the ground. How should I cut them back and start over and try to use the more flexible rose canes to get it over the arch? Or
well, use the new canes that come up and also the new branches. What you could do is cut that off, and the new shoots will likely grow vertical. Not always guaranteed, but it might go vertical. If you don't want them growing horizontal, you could try just slightly bending them up, but
okay.
when you're going to train a vining plant to a trellis, you really need to use new wood, succulent wood that is pliable. It's hard to bring something up that's not there. But like I say, if you cut it back, watch the shoots that come off of those cut back branches, because they may go vertical, perpendicular to the ground, and you can then shape those into the trellis.
All right. Good luck with that, Barb. And stay on the line. Our producer will give you the email address that you need. And back to some email questions here from Tim in Polk City. I've been overseeding my lawn with shady fescue to fill in some bare spots. I also put down a seed starter fertilizer at the same time. It's been more than 2 weeks, and I water every night. How long does it take for grass seed to germinate?
1 to 3 weeks.
All right. So you're still in the window.
You're still in the window, but
it's getting
to the end of the
however how old was that seed is the question. Grass seed does not overwinter very well. The germination rate goes down, so if this was seed that you've had in your shed or garage for a number of years, I don't think he said that, did he?
No, he didn't say that, although it could be the case. And it sounds like Tim probably just take your chances now and wait until August when you've got a better shot of it working, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
All right. He also says, I also just planted basil and oregano from seed on Sunday. Did I miss my opportunity?
No. Perfect. It's basil is a very cold temperature sensitive plant. And oregano is a hardy perennial, but that seed will germinate really well right now.
Okay, here's a question from Nick. Last year, we had a heavy infestation of earwigs. They ate our marigolds and zinnias down to just stems. We understand they like moist, dark conditions, so we're wondering, with the rainy period we're experiencing now, is there anything we can do if they become a problem again? We do mulch around our plants.
Keep watching. I've not had earwig questions yet this year, but it's time for them to start, so they could be out there. They could be waiting. Yes, they love to live between the saucer and the bottom of the pot. They love to live under the mulch and so forth, but we'll just have to wait and see when they finally arrive. Earwigs are funny. We'd never had them 40 years ago. In the last 10 years, they've become really abundant. I'm hoping this is a phase and they grow out of it and they disappear again, but maybe not.
All right, here's a question from Fred. I've saved basil seeds in a cool, dry place, but I've had difficulty getting them to germinate inside and outside. Do you have any tips on storage and germination for basil seeds?
Some seeds just do not keep very long. They have a very short shelf life as far as seeds, and basil tends to be one of them. Even if you store them cool and dry, you may not have good germination the following year. So I would suggest that they get fresh seed. I think you'll be much better off.
All right. So maybe that's one that's difficult to save yourself?
Yes, it is.
All right. And a second question from Fred. Do you have a suggestion for a one-season ground cover for a garden that's in an urban area? It should not cause complaints from the neighbors.
A one-season.
Okay, maybe not.
I'm trying to think. There
something he only wants it to last one season?
Yeah.
Plant oats.
And the neighbors shouldn't complain about oats, right?
Yeah, they might. And they are kind of a short season, though. That's the thing.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Well, you could go annual ryegrass and mow it for a while, couldn't you?
Yeah. Sure, yeah. Some of the various grasses come to mind for that.
Well, and if the oats are a short season, if they complain, it's almost over, right?
Yes, that's true.
Right.
All right. From Bethany in Iowa City, I transplanted my peppers, tomatoes, and melons a few days ago. Was it too early, and should I cover them with this cool weather?
Where'd she say she was from?
Iowa City.
Oh, no. She should be fine. We're experiencing some cool weather. We're down in the mid to upper 40s. The tomato plant should be fine. Actually, this cool, rainy weather really helps them get established pretty well. So it's much better than sunny and 90 that we experienced a few days ago. So this is a good time to plant.
All right. And last question from Emily in State Center. My peonies were damaged by what I assume was herbicide in the farm field next to our property. Will they outgrow that damage?
Maybe. It depends on how much and which herbicide it was. If it's all just out on the tips, the peonies could still bloom, but they're not going to be strong and vigorous for next year. What else, Linda?
Well, yes, I think it depends on what product and how severe it was hit. Only time will tell. There's nothing you can do about it right now. Keep that peony well watered if it gets dry, pamper it a little bit more than you ordinarily would, but you just had time will tell.
All right. Well, Linda and Donald, thank you both so much for being here today.
You're welcome. Thank you,
Charity. It's always a pleasure.
Linda Nave, ISU Extension Specialist in Value-Added Agriculture. Donald Lewis, Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University and Entomologist with ISU Extension. We'll be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.